Well, hello, Facebook, and welcome to our Wednesday webcast. And this is the final one in this series on race, racism. And I am, as ever, Scott Castanrennie. And he is, as ever,
Al Coates.
Al Coates. And this week we are joined by someone who we think we're going to have quite a bit of fun with, actually. On a very serious topic, but just in the last 10 minutes, we've had an amazing conversation. Not much of it won't be repeated, but a lot of it is kind of keeping us in suspense a little bit, myself.
We've laughed like drains.
Yeah, exactly. So we're joined by Susan Cousins. Hello, Susan. Welcome.
Hello.
Perhaps you'd just like to introduce yourself to whoever is watching and tell them a bit about yourself.
Right, okay. So my name's Susan Cousins, and I kind of tracked this organisation down. I can't remember what you're called. Adoption something? Adoption? Anyway,
Adoption Fostering Podcast.
That's it. And tracked you down and thought, oh, this is really interesting. And I just thought that maybe I had something to offer practice this organisation. My background's very unusual. I'm going to use the term BAME, by the way. Can I just say I'm going to use the term BAME because I'm not sure about people of colour, because not everybody who's of colour is of colour. There might be mixed race. Like, for example, my granddaughter's blonde with blue eyes.
Yeah.
And my own children are mixed race, and they're not necessarily perceived as being a person of colour. So I have difficulty with that. I have difficulty with all sorts of other terminology. So I hope you don't mind everybody out there who finds the term BAME reductive and useless. I'm afraid I'm going to use it today.
Well, we hope you'll correct us as well if we go the wrong way as well. So it's all good. Don't worry.
Okay, great, great.
So you were introducing yourself.
Oh, yeah, I was introducing myself. Oh, yeah. So, I'm not quite sure what to say about how to introduce myself.
Mm. Do you want to just keep it a secret as the conversation unfolds? Because obviously you're an adopted adult or an adult who was adopted. I mean, that's another kind of phrase that is all about language, isn't it? How do you refer to yourself?
Right, that's very interesting. I refer to myself as a transnational adoptee. That's how I refer to myself. And yeah. So, you know, I have quite an incredible story. And so I was transnationally adopted, found on the pavement in Mumbai, taken to an orphanage. And I don't know how long I spent in the orphanage. I've got no idea. And then adopted by two white parents. And then taken into a family of seven. Well, I weren't seven at the time. There were only two other children who were trans. So some of my brothers and sisters were transnationally adopted, that is, from different countries outside the UK. And some of them were BAME children adopted within the UK.
Okay.
Of all different backgrounds. So some of us are African Caribbean, some of us are mixed of French and Pakistani or Bangladeshi, or I'm South Asian, Mumbai, I think, totally. Mm. I think I'm a Southern Indian, okay. I think, but I don't really know.
We were chatting before, and I said when you got in touch with me, I struggle's not the right word, but there was this juxtaposition between your story, and because obviously there's a clip on that people can see on the Facebook page of, you know, how it kind of fleshes out that story and a bit of your childhood. There's this just juxtaposition of, you know, who you are and your story and your name, Susan. Which, you know, if I shut my eyes, Susan, I think, you know, this is maybe my problem. I think it's an incredibly English, you know, English name. So, I mean, even on that level, is there complexities about you sort of being dropped from this Mumbai place into kind of England? What was that? I've raised things rather than asked questions there.
Yeah, no, it was really good. Well, about my name, always been really difficult. And when I was called Susan Murphy, with an Irish name, that was really incredibly difficult to manage. I had a really tough time at school. This isn't a rosy story, and I'm somebody with a sense of humour, but it's not a good story about adoption in some ways. Mm. Well, I guess other people can be the judge of that, and in some senses I can judge it, in other ways I can't, because it involves seven other people, and including my parents. But what's really interesting about my name is it brought me a lot of problems, because I'd turn up for jobs when I was young. You know, I used to do Saturday jobs and all sorts of things like that, and people would say, no, you're not you, and you know, how come you've got that name, and no, I don't think you're Susan Murphy. and all sorts of terrible things would happen to me, you know, in the days when nobody had any idea about race. But then I discovered my sort of real name, which is Ethel, E-T-H-E-L. Now, I, you know, in Ethel Maria Pinto, which is Victorian name, and because the Portuguese invaded and colonized parts of India, and particularly the Goan part, which is probably where I come from, because I'm quite dark for an Indian, then I had this name Ethel. So I actually thought I got off quite lightly with Susan.
Yeah.
I don't really think that I look like an Ethel, really.
But what's that? I mean, you describe growing up and this juxtaposition of, you know, who you are and where you were. Was that something that was talked about? Was that something that was that you know, did anyone sit down and talk to you about that? You know, your parents or people around you?
Well, it's really interesting because I was having a look at this book today. I think it's quite a famous book, and I can't remember the name of it, about adoption. It talks about demonstration of emotional disturbance in adopted children. And I think that, you know, my parents were thoroughly emotionally disturbed, and they had no idea how to bring up seven BAME children. Hmm. They had sort of, you know, that kind of real sense of entitlement. So they had no idea about our experiences, our life experiences, what it would be like for us. And they had a romanticized image of India, and which was a white, I would say, upper middle class hippie image of India. Mm-hmm. And which I didn't share at all. I mean, I fought against it. I refused to be Indian. I was black and I was American, and I was buying all sorts of Harlem gospel choir things when I was really young, borrowing all sorts of stuff from the library that didn't relate to me in any way whatsoever. Mm. I was desperate to kind of figure out my own identity, which meant that I just, you know, I kind of became African Caribbean, because that's what I did. I rejected my parents' view of Indian at a very young age. I mean, I didn't, there's not a time when I didn't know I was adopted. I, you know, my parents are white, my brothers and sisters are all different colors, and
yeah,
you know, I mean, it was, we looked ridiculous walking down the street. It was the family was overwhelming. It was overwhelming. It was just a sort of like, I can't really describe it, but it was a bit like living in a family that was a children's home sort of thing.
So, I mean, can I ask, and this is a very personal question, please feel free to move on if you want to. So were you part of some sort of egalitarian project, or, you know, with this idea of your parents wanting to build this community of the children of the world, or were they, did they want to be parents? Were you a mission?
My mother, my mother couldn't have children.
Right.
And she had an obsession with India from her background. Her background was quite a sort of colonialist background. Her grandfather sailed on the Cutty Sark, just a famous ship, and had tea plantations in India. So she was really kind of into that idea of things. And so, you know, she couldn't have children. They were both Catholics. My mother was, when she was living, she married my father in India. She rejected him when she first met him. And then when she found out that he was going to work in India, my dad was an industrial chemist. And he set up factories all over India. So when she discovered that my father had gone to India, she decided that she wants to marry him. So she got on a plane because she loved India. And then the day she landed, she got married to him. And wow. They were both Catholics, and they spent their time sort of wandering around orphanages and visiting Mother Teresa and all sorts of things like that. And eventually sort of just fell into the kind of adopting people through the Catholic Church.
Right.
And all those connections.
Yeah. That is really interesting. Because you wouldn't put that on a backstory. That is, even in itself, just unpacking all of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it is an overwhelming story. It's really difficult because we never really had the chance to not be known to have been adopted. So we always knew we were, because we never could not have been. And I swear that I remember the first time I saw a white person in the orphanage. I just have such a strong memory, and I can't think it's anywhere else but in this orphanage. And then seeing this like I remember seeing this white person come towards me and think, and I was so scared because I thought it was a ghost or something. I didn't know what a ghost was, obviously, because I was under a year old. But I remember being absolutely terrified of this white person. And I think in that BBC film, there's a bit that my mother's written about me being absolutely terrified. Yeah. I mean, I was also severely ill, severely malnutritioned. I had all sorts of things wrong with me. And as we all did, the three of us that were adopted in India at that sort of in that particular era, and we were all really, really ill. So to answer your question, my parents couldn't have children. They were in love with all things non-white in a kind of weird way, in a kind of exoticizing, what they call exoticizing the other.
So how do you feel when you look at, you know, we see some elements of celebrity adoption culture, don't we, where, you know, nice white people ship off across the world. What are your reflections on that?
Well, I suppose I think that it's really difficult because, and this is I'm going to talk about some very difficult things here. So I suppose this is about entitlement, and it's about the access that men and women in this country have to, what do they call it? Things like the pill, and what do they call that? Family planning.
Contraception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, contraception, family planning, and all that business. And then people in countries, poorer countries, not having access to those things. And I don't think people even begin to understand that. And also the kind of corruption that goes on. And I've known people to adopt children, and I'm thinking to myself, where did you get this child from? It's illegal to adopt a child from India. It's illegal. So what are you doing with that child? So there's part of me that gets extremely angry about it and upset about it. And then whenever I see it, I immediately feel really upset. And it's too big. It's much bigger than me. And I guess there's questions I want to ask about this. So one of the questions I'd like to ask is how. So in my family, and this is hard to take. That, you know, we've got a. There's been a low life expectancy. I've lost three brothers and sisters to extremely traumatic deaths, and I think they're all tied up with being adopted. And I wonder how many. So I wonder how. What's the life expectancy of a transnational adopted child, as opposed to a UK adopted BAME child? Yeah. And if I had my life over again, I'd be trying to get to university and doing research on that particular subject. But also, how many BAME children remain with their not foster carers, but with the people who've adopted them? Because I'm now discovering there are people that I know personally who've sent their children back. After being adopted back into care. And there's something about the whole issue around adoption, which is, I don't know if these kind of, I'm hoping these issues are coming up within some of the conversations that you're having with other people. And I know that it's really difficult to hear some of the things that I'm saying.
I don't think it's anything we've not heard in terms of the kind of, we know some of the kind of extremes and severity of these things. Interestingly, and you won't have heard this, but we, when we kicked off this series of webcasts on race, we spoke to the CEO of International Adoption Centre. Is that the name of them? IEC. Satwinder, and he's been on with us quite regularly, and we've talked about no end of things with him. We've talked about LGBT adoption and all this sort of thing. And he would, you know, he's kind of, we talked to him when he first took over as CEO, didn't we? And he is the first BAME, I'm going to use terminology, I'm not sure. He's the first BAME person who's actually leading an adoption organisation in the UK, which is a massive thing, obviously. But he's very knowledgeable and stuff like that. And I think some of what you've just said there kind of reflects some of the information that he has as well in terms of, you know, children. You know, is there actually a not necessarily a registered, but is there official numbers of children who have been adopted or brought to the UK from abroad under the pretense that they're adopted or whether they are adopted or not? And I think that's a really kind of important part because, you know, obviously we're not talking about recently in terms of your adoption, no offense, you know, but you're not kind of a teenager, are you? So things will have moved on, we hope, in some ways, that, you know, there's a massive difference between then and now. But equally, it's a really kind of hard one to call because we just don't know, you know, we don't know if this kind of thing does go on, you know. Does that bug you?
Yes, I think data.
We don't know the figures. We don't know the numbers. We don't know whether it happens or whether it doesn't.
Yeah, I did post something on website quite. I was being quite cheeky, and I to some adoption organisation, I said, "Where are your statistics? Have you got data on this?" And they just replied saying yes. And I thought, "Well, where is it then? Show it to me." And I want to know these questions. Yeah. I want to know what the difference is between white children going back into care after being adopted, not fostered. I want to know what the life expectancy is of BAME UK children who are adopted, and what the life expectancy of transnational. I would imagine that the life expectancy of transnationally adopted children from, say, South America or India or Africa being continent, is lower. That would be my guess. But wouldn't it be interesting to know those facts?
Would. Yeah, it would be massively interesting.
Because the statistics in relation to adopted adults or adults who are adopted, I think they're 1 in 4, they're 4 more times likely to commit suicide.
Yeah.
And it remains problematic, doesn't it, that we're removing children from their culture, there's lots of really complicated stories. I don't know whether you've read the book by Catherine Joyce, The Children Catchers, which looks at the US transnational adoption culture and how a lot of it is basically financial. There's a lot of money. It comes down to filthy money. And I think there's the Hague Convention, which kind of which states who can and who can't, and people sign up to it, but minimum standards about how it's done. But there's agencies kind of just skirting around that and just move on to the next country, looking for natural disasters. Again, it's not a very good question. It's just a statement that. When you look at the whole system, how does that make you feel? This is that's your story. It's where in some ways it's part of where you came from. How was that for you growing up into adulthood and kind of having to maybe reframe your story to people constantly?
Because we were on. I mean, that Panorama program. We were on Panorama when I was 9 in that film. And so we were shot.
You were really put out there, weren't you?
Yeah, shot into all sorts of publicity, into we were in loads of magazines as well. The equivalent of Hello magazine. I don't read magazines these days, but not many people do they? But all those kind of magazines, we were all over the place, and Radio 4, and goodness knows what. And it was just terrible. I got so much I'd love to say, and especially about
you can't say it or you can't say it. It's entirely your choice. We're very,
Well, no, I'm sort of thinking I'm running out of time and I got so much to say.
No, you're fine.
Just keep going.
Keep going.
We'll not turn it off.
There's two things. So I always say to people, what do you want? Do you want the kind of sugar-coated story of my life? Because I can make that sound wonderful. Or do you want the nitty-gritty of my life? And do you want the difficult parts of my life? And what I found out is that people can't actually handle the difficult parts of my life, and they can't. So I tend not to talk about it. And I'm going to talk about some of that tonight. But I think one of the things I do want to talk about is the experience of racism with white parents. That to me was one of the most difficult things to manage with my parents, because they had no idea of the experience that. And I can only speak for myself in this family. I can't speak for my other brothers and sisters. But. That they had just had no idea that it would affect us, walking to school, being in school, being bullied in school, being spat out in the streets, being physically assaulted in the streets. And also my parents were extremely strict, and they were dysfunctional, extremely intelligent people who we never had any social workers come around to check if everything was all right. Everything wasn't all right. My parents were strict and
so can I ask you about specifically then you talk about your experience of racism so and your parents, were they aware, or did you feel able to share it, were they just oblivious, or what was difficult was
it was telling them anything about racism, because they would either overreact or underreact, and do what white people do in general: overreact, underreact, act with denial and disbelief, and try and persuade you that it didn't happen, like gaslighting. So they're all, so they could do any number of those things. And that's really confusing for a child. And I remember that a lot of, you know, I think a really terrible thing happened to me when I was about 11. I talk about it in the book, and this guy, I was walking through the bus station coming back from school, and this guy's, he was about 30 years old, well, he looked about 30, maybe he's about 20, but he stuck his leg out between my legs, and I fell onto the concrete floor of the bus station, and I cut my head open, I cut my knees, I was quite badly injured, I went down with a lot of force, and nobody in that bus station helped me. I was an 11-year-old schoolgirl, and nobody helped me. I had to get up, I was bleeding. I was really badly injured. And then I had to walk home and I had to clean myself up. I had to get myself looking like nothing had ever happened to me because I knew that my parents would immediately call the police. There would be some kind of horrendous thing that I'd have to go through. And there were seven of us going through the same things all the time. So there's constant dramas around race in my family because we were always being attacked or assaulted or something was happening. And I was getting attacked most because I was the darkest.
Right.
And so, they didn't know how to respond, and they kind of, if you talked about it too much, they would start disbelieving you. They couldn't find a way because they had no idea what it was really like.
I mentioned this, everyone with the race thing, and it's very similar to being part of the LGBTQ community, unless you've experienced it, homophobia, whether it's physical, verbal, online, however it happens, unless you've kind of had it yourself, you really don't get it, do you? And I think that kind of transcends through all those generations, regardless, if my grandparents were alive and knew what I went through, they wouldn't get it. Do you know what I'm saying? I think I'm not taking away from your experience. I'm just saying that, I think it's very difficult unless you are that person to say, this happened today. And, it's kind of, it's unbelievable to people who just haven't experienced that. Sorry, Al, I'm kind of picking on you because as the Northeastern white man with the Czech shirt on, heterosexual white man, should I say? Yeah, sorry. Odd one out. No, but you know what I'm saying. It's like you've probably had your issues as well with certain bits that you could probably pluck out your head, but it's very similar in that respect.
Let's not feel sorry for the white man.
It's not the same. It's not the same, and I'm not saying it's the same. I'm just saying it's very kind of there's a little bit of a link there for me. So I kind of, I'm just sitting there.
It's a window into that world, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was intrigued to. So what did that make you do? Because as you were talking, I was thinking, oh, yeah, but that was then. But actually what we see is that was then, but this is now.
Yeah.
So reflecting on your experience of racism, what did that do to you? How did that impact upon your sense of identity and who you were and how you respond to racism?
Well, I didn't, I just shut down. And my mother used to say to me, well, you just don't talk, Susan. Look at me now. you just don't talk. And I completely shut down. I think I probably shut down I was so scared. Every time I left the house, I was completely terrified. I mean, this is really difficult to say as well, but white men in cars would stop and try and pick me up at bus stations, and all sorts of really dangerous things were continuously happening to me as a very young child. And I suppose I kind of grew up terrified, completely shut down, spent most of my childhood stealing. I'm sorry.
That's okay,
You and Woolies at the pick and mix, were you? Yeah. Oh, that's a little bit more extreme than that. I mean, come on.
Yeah. No, chicken and pick and mix and things.
Oh, that's all right.
Money. And then painting. Okay. Painting.
But and then you describe quite a traumatizing environment where you've got nowhere to go with that. Any child, the last thing you want is your parents making a scene. No children want that. But neither do you want your parents to ignore you. And in relation to the impact of racism, what it does is it, you just don't do either, do you?
No.
It shuts you down.
Yeah, so, I completely shut down. And there was, this is a big family with seven brothers and sisters, and my parents constantly taking us to children's home, looking at new children they could adopt. and and all that kind of stuff. So there's, you know, and they were extremely bright, clever people. That there was always, it was like this kind of, my mother wrote poetry and read stories on Radio 4. My father was extremely bright and clever, and there was all this like people coming around all the time. And I mean, it was a very exciting childhood. So the other side of the story that I say about my personal experience outside of home was an incredibly exciting, vibrant, dysfunctional family life. And we didn't, friends never came to our house. I don't think they could survive it because it was just too much. There was so much going on all the time. And so,
but there's a blind spot, isn't there? There's you're living in this sort of blind spot as to deeply intelligent but mildly oblivious. Can I move you on a little bit and maybe talk about as you grew up into adulthood and what is that? You demand an explanation, don't you? Is that the people are curious? That you can if they meet you, but then do you bring them home? Were people just Were you constantly having to explain your who and how and why?
Yeah, totally. I went, I was brought up in a school, the only people that were BAME in my school were my family. There was only one other Asian family in the whole town. So it was us. And that was incredibly difficult to deal with. And now I'm running away now because I can't remember the question that you, what was the question now?
Well, just really, were you having it as you grew into adulthood? Were you still having to explain yourself and kind of make sense of that story for other people?
Yes, yes, I was, and I still do. Always having to explain myself.
To us now.
Talk about my name. I kind of like, and in some ways, I didn't mind that too much because at least people were talking to me. It didn't seem to be, when people were being curious, it didn't seem to be aggressive to me at that time as a child. But as I grew up and I got older, became a teenager, I just became massively political. I just buried myself in everything that was going on in the States and in the civil rights movement. And I didn't really know what they were talking about, but I sort of thought it meant something to me. Just got caught on Angela Davis and people like that. And then I started the anti-apartheid movement when I was a little bit older in Bradford and got into that and wrote loads of angry stuff against white feminism. How white women weren't on our side at all. And yeah, and this amazing thing happened to me. So this guy, there was a guy, a producer on Channel 4, I can't remember his name, he was very famous. I used to talk about that black something or other, black something program. Anyway, he got hold of me from Spare Rib because I was writing all these angry letters to white women. And he rang me up and he said, we'd like you to go to Greenham Common. Do you know what Greenham Common is?
Yeah.
Sorry. Just, you seem quite young.
And
they said, so we'd like you to go to Greenham Common. And I said, well, what to do what? And so, because there's no black women down there. This is a very famous person, and it's probably lucky I can't remember his name. And I said, well, what do you mean, go down there? And he said, well, no, we'll put you up in a hotel, and then you can just wander around the tents. We'll make this tent, and we'll put this tent there, and then I've got these six other women from all over the country, and we're going to bring you down to Greenham Common, and we're going to place you there. I'm going to create this program about it. I wrote him such a... I'm trying to think of the word.
Forthright.
Sorry?
Forthright.
Forthright, that's it. Thank you very much. A forthright letter telling him off and complaining to Channel 4. And that's an extreme, isn't it, of who are you, what are you, and a kind of placing us into a situation where we almost become a commodity for the entertainment of, white people, I guess. Yeah.
Which returns us to the celebrity, that celebrity culture, or which is kind of we... Because that's elevated, isn't it? That's seen as maybe within our community, and we would see that one way, but actually a lot of people go, oh, it's a good thing. But is it a good,
Well, yeah, it's funny now because I'm getting a little bit tiny bit well-known.
Right.
Well-known. which I brought on the pub myself. But at least that was driven for my own passion. Anyway, sorry, Al, what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to ask about you, because I've watched the clip, the news clip, and you raise lots of really interesting issues. I'm going to jump onto one of those if possible. One of the issues that we regularly talk about is people's identity in relation to their story. And obviously your story's been well publicised by your parents for initially, but also you talk about actually it's a brick wall. Beyond knowing where you were brought from, you don't know anything about yourself or your story. And has that been something that, you know, has that something that's been, you've resolved, you're quite happy to go, well, that's just it? Or is it something that comes and goes or hovers?
No, so every morning when I wake up, I think about my real parents. And I've done that ever since I've known that I'm alive and I'm here. I've always thought about my real parents. And I haven't thought about my mother. I've thought about, I've got this big family elsewhere. And that I felt huge amounts of guilt at being adopted and surviving. So this makes me really upset. But that's okay. I don't mind being upset. I'm a trained counsellor, and it's okay to be upset. But I feel I've got these family out there in India who are, and my fantasy is that they were really poor. They had no money, and I can't find them or get hold of them. I can't help them. I can't help my brothers and sisters. I can't help anybody. And you know, who what other children did my mother have? And there's nothing I can do. And in this, you know, there's a part of my adoption which wasn't quite legal, even though I am totally legal. don't say it, Al's saying, don't say it. I'm a naturalised British. I'm totally legally adopted here, but you know, because of that, and there are no records. I'm talking about records here in children's homes. I can't do anything. So yeah, every day I think about my real parents, and every day I think about my adopted parents. Every day, and every day I struggle with it. It's not a day that I don't struggle with it. Not a single day. There's never been a day in my life when I've not woken up thinking about it. It doesn't. That sounds really odd. I know, but
I don't think it sounds odd. I'm kind of in awe of you to be able to, number one, say that quite bluntly, because actually that's the truth. But secondly, to be able to deal with that day in, day out. I mean, you strike me as a very kind of confident, well-educated and well-adjusted human, shall we say, from one of a better phrase using. But actually to have that in your head day in, day out, you know, there must be days where you just want to hide under the duvet, you know, or that must affect you. It must have an impact on you.
It does. And, you know, there's, you know, I'm classically not, I'm sort of, you know, I've suffered from depression. I've suffered from anxiety. Yeah. I've suffered from suicidal thinking. I've suffered from a lot of damage from the family and for the loss of my brothers and sisters in traumatic deaths.
Yeah.
And some of them at a very young age, some of them when they were older, but nothing, you know, nothing easy to come to terms with. Nothing at all. And I think that I'm not, you know, I give an impression. I mean, I thought about this today, and I thought, well, how can I survive? How can I survive this family? And I think it's because, in a sense, I had so little. You know, when you're brought up in a family that big, you don't get much, because there's not enough to go around. There's not enough love. There was enough food, but it felt like there wasn't. There was always a struggle for everything, and wearing secondhand clothes all the time, and hand-me-downs. Even my parents were quite wealthy, actually, but they were always kind of doing things, you know, strictly or carefully or whatever. So I think that training to be a counsellor really helped me. Going to counselling, that was a massive, massive breakthrough in my life. Yeah. And even though I didn't talk about my adoption, at least I knew that I was depressed. At least I knew that some of the things I was experiencing were hypervigilance. I'm still hypervigilant. If anybody sees me walking around, I'm like this all the time, like some sort of Zebedee. My expectation of life is, it's always been cast against the background of my real family who have nothing. So I live my life thinking, I wake up in the morning and I think, I've got food, I've got shelter, I'm not dying. Mm-hmm. And this is a really difficult thing to talk about, but I also think about my own death every day, probably. Mm. I always have done, because I was made to feel like I, that my life was in danger from a really young age. I was constantly being attacked or strange things happening to me. I didn't even understand. I do now. And so I come from this sort of low expectation point. So everything that comes my way, even a sunny day, I'm overly grateful for everything that I've got. And to me, that's the saddest part of who I am. And it might sound great to be overly grateful for everything you have, but it doesn't, it's not really.
Yeah. It's not rooted. It's rooted in a very dark place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, I don't know about you, Scott, but you're slightly disarming because you're a very engaging, gregarious personality, but actually what you're talking about is really quite difficult stuff. So I really appreciate that. And I don't want to kind of just keep ploughing on because you seem okay. I want to be sensitive.
We're not Jeremy Paxman, to be fair.
No, no, but I want to talk because I've counselled a lot of BAME people who've been adopted, and I think that some of the things, you know, when you hear your own experiences being reflected by somebody else, that's why I've come in tonight, because I know there are people out there who feel and think the same way I do, and they might never hear it. And there are white people there who are going to adopt BAME children who don't have any idea, really, of the kind of things that you might be going through, that a BAME person might go through still, you know, in these times. And I've seen some terrible things happening to BAME children.
So just...
gone.
Sorry, no, I didn't want to cut you off. So just on that, actually, because that was where my next question was going, was on, and Al looks shocked I'm asking a question, was about that white people adopting BAME children. I mean, you know, I'm not asking you for your personal sense, but what kind of... Do you have advice? Do you have an opinion? I mean, I'm sure you've got an opinion, whether you're wanting to share it, I don't know. But.
Can I add to the context of that is that one of the discussions we've been having is that in the UK, there remains more BAME children in the care system waiting to be adopted than there are BAME adoptive parents waiting or looking for children. So there's that contradiction of children who, you know, it's a multi-layered conversation, but in one sense, there's this ultimate question that we keep coming back to is, can it be done? What should it be done? And if it should be done or it could be done, how do you do it? How does a white man look after a black child, white family, white couple? I mean, you're allowed to disagree with it wholeheartedly. I'm sure you'll say what you want. Please do.
I think it's all about, nothing's simple, is it? Everything's complex. And I couldn't possibly turn around and say there are certain white people who just can't adopt BAME children, but I think that's systemic. So the reason there aren't enough BAME parents to adopt BAME children is possibly because, you know, of their social background, and it's probably because of poverty, it's probably all sorts of things, housing, all that stuff. So until that shifts and change, then that won't not gonna happen in this country. And I also think that my kind of emotional response is I don't want any white person to adopt a BAME child. That's my emotional response. My logical, thought-out response is that, of course, white people can adopt BAME children. But they have to be... it has to be something... You have to understand it in a really complex way. So, for example, I got these... They weren't really friends, but these people that I knew who adopted a BAME child from South America. And while I was in front of them in some sort of barbecue party or something, they were sort of saying, Carlos or whatever his name was making up a name. He's much better off in South America. He prefers it there than he does here, in front of the six-year-old child, in front of them. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? Yeah. What, with the damage that was being done in this mother saying to this child, and she had her own children as well, so she had two white children and one BAME child. And so when people talk about, so people talk very simplistically, in my view, about, well, we need to keep, these BAME children need to be in touch with their country of origin. If you'd have asked me to be in touch with my country of origin when I was six, you've got to be absolutely kidding. Mm. I just would have thrown the book at you. I would have created such a scene. But as I got older, my parents offered to take me to India when I was about 18, or they were a bit, they wanted me to miss my A-levels, and they wanted me to go and do art all around India or something stupid. And will you come to India? And I said, no, I want to do my A-levels. I'm not going to go to India with you on some sort of jaunt that you're going to go on, you know. And So even then I didn't want to be Indian. I was black. I was African Caribbean, and I was in the civil rights movement. I wasn't Indian. I am now fully accept my Indianness and embrace it massively. But I was rejected by Indian people as a young person as well. So I had all that to cope with, you know, I wasn't Indian, that Indian girls could relate to Indian families. So there's all that too. So the answer to your question is I've seen things happen with white people adopting FAME children that have made me incredibly worried about where we are with this. And all I would say is and that's why I've come on here today, is let the conversation be as deeply complex as it possibly can, because it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Cool. I mean... it's interesting. I mean, like you said, we've done 5 weeks, and at the end of every conversation we've had, people have come on and said, we could have done it with a bit more. So last week we spoke to a black single woman who was an adopter, and she really clearly reflected the systemic challenges that she's experienced. Yeah. We've had a white couple who've adopted a black child. We've had Satwinder, who's a professional in the system. And again, fantastically thought-provoking. But your reaction really is that if we could, because the issues are around poverty, aren't they? The issues are around racism. That's what we need to fix, because it's like a pragmatic answer, isn't it? Yes. Yes, it's only a pragmatic yes. It's not actually a yes of conviction, is it? In relation to adoption.
Not really. There's part of me that also thinks that if they improve children's homes, that might be a way forward. I don't know, because see, the other thing is, you know, when you talk, you said something about when you're very articulate and I am this person. I think what's happened to me is the reason I've been able to stay healthy and get over some of the things that I've had to get over an enormous amount in my life. But the reason I've always felt that there's a kind of resilience in me that came from my real family. There's something in me that's just always been there. And so I've always been like this. So I've always been, even in my worst moments as a child, and even in my complete shutdown where I didn't speak for years, I was always like this inside, and, you know, to myself. I was kind of like a sort of Zebedee person, and I've got loads of energy. I've always had this like wired up energy in me, and that's really seen me through. But one of the things that I would say, that I really want to say, is that so I am this person, but I'm also this deeply affected person. You know, in counseling they use this term integration, where you just take every part of you and that becomes you. And, you know, I love my parents who adopted me, and I love them with a passion. Yeah. I hate them with a passion, and I can have both. I can have both of those things, and I love my family. And the other thing in my family is that some of my brothers and sisters have been able to contact their real parents. That's been incredibly difficult and personally painful for me, because I can't do it, because they were FAME, but they were adopted in this country.
Yeah,
and that's been really hard, because they've been sort of flashing around photographs on Facebook, which is, you know, I'm not on Facebook for that reason. Of their newly found families and all their relatives and everything. And then there's some of the people in my family who can't do that. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just so complicated, isn't it? I mean, the more we talk, the more I realise how complicated this whole thing is. And I'm just so pleased at what you guys are doing, that you're having these conversations and that you're raising all this awareness amongst people. I think it's just fantastic what you're doing.
Well, I think there's more and more to be discussed. I don't think it ends here. That's the issue, isn't it? So, go on, Al. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's a little bit disappointing that it's left to the likes of me and Scott, if I'm honest. Because I don't mean that to disparage ourselves or false modesty. I just think that you would hope that, you know, that the systems would start to pick this stuff up. Now, Susan, what I'm really keen is that people kind of access your resources, because I know that you're an author and you're an academic and you're a counsellor. And so, like, you know, wave your book in the air. What's it called?
Yeah. I'm going to wave my book in the air.
Overcoming Everyday Racism by Susan Cousins.
And it's amazing.
That's a JKP book, isn't it?
It is a JKP book.
Well, We like a bit of JKP, so we'll get in touch with them so we can maybe get a copy and we can review it as well.
Oh, you can. Oh, yeah, yeah. You can. Because you've got Stephen Jones following you, haven't you?
Oh, we're... Yes. He's had to start sending us two books because I was getting upset. Three, sorry, because we give one away. So we give one away.
Yeah.
Al reads one, but I wasn't getting them because I claim to be this idiot who only likes pop-up books and pictures. And I can't honestly give a critique of something if I've not seen it, you know, even if I only read the first chapter. I mean, you know, so they now send us three books.
Well, that's good. But I would say that this is a really good book for people who are adopting BAME children to read.
Yeah.
Because it's written through the lens of a BAME person, not about adoption, but about their experience of being BAME.
I think we need those resources. I think generally we need books like that. But I think, you know, me as a social worker, I need to get that. But me as a dad of children who are mixed, I need to really bring my A game to this parenting malarkey to kind of have a window into their world. People can also follow you on Twitter, can't they? And I see that you're growing, and so it's at Susan Cousins. We'll link you into all the podcasts so people can find you if they're listening. They'll find you. So Susan, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I think that you've raised the process of doing this, if anything, is just raising more questions, and it's the questions that make us go away and have a good hard think about what we're doing. So,
and
thank you
to everybody who's watched these Wednesday webcasts. We're not finished. We're just going to have a couple of weeks off.
Yeah, lie down in a dark room.
Because, well, these were a kind of post lockdown kind of experiment to see if people were interested and whether we could be bothered doing them, to be honest with you. Because with the podcast and work and all that sort of stuff. And the truth is that we're getting such great feedback from them that we are going to continue them. But we're just going to have a slight break and we're going to do a plan, aren't we, Al? We're going to do a plan of some topics that we're going to do. And then we're going to come back maybe the end of October-ish time, maybe.
Yes.
So, but thank you for watching, and we will see you on Saturday when the podcast comes out.
Excellent. Thanks, Susan.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.